The story that shocked the world continues to break hearts. The nation bowed its head in sympathy for America's golden couple. August 12, 1932, world-famous pilot Colonel John Armstrong and his wife Sonia awake in horror to find their only child, Daisy, taken from her crib at night in her sleeping suit. Desperate, the Armstrongs pay the ransom, but the child, little Daisy, is found dead, murdered. Sonia Armstrong, daughter of stage actress Linda Arden, is with child when she receives the news. The shock sends her into premature labor. Neither she nor the infant survive. Colonel Armstrong cannot bear the burden of grief and is soon found dead of a gunshot wound, self-inflicted.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to, it appears that our bad luck has worsened. That is...
A passenger has died on the train.
He was murdered.
Good God. Murder here?
Alas, madame.
God rest his soul.
As we are snowbound, I have elected to take the case and find for my friend, Monsieur Book, the criminal.
And why you?
My name is Hercule Poirot. And I am probably the greatest detective in the world. I will speak to all of you in time. For the moment, I must recommend that you remain in your compartments with the doors locked.
I feel like a prisoner here.
It is for your own safety. If there was a murder, then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us. On the train. Now.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your host, Jason Bishop, and on the train to nowhere... with me is Sam Stepanenko.
I never did get that damn private berth.
No. Yeah, sorry. A promise is not kept.
No, I never did get one. But, you know, it's a pretty nice train.
Yeah. I also dug the mustache protector you had.
Yes, it made me laugh. It's so ridiculous.
There's some great stuff. We're going to be talking about The Murder on the Orient Express, the Agatha Christie classic novel brought to life in 1974, and again recently in 2017. There was a 2001, I want to say, 2005, somewhere around there, television film. We're not going to touch on that one.
Because we don't do TV.
Oh, that's right. We don't do TV. But it does star Alfred Molina, who I can see being a good Poirot.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
I actually can. It does bother me that there's been no real French Poirot, though.
He's Belgian.
Belgian, but he's French-speaking, right? I mean, they've always been English or American,
yeah.
Right? They've never actually had a French-speaking actor. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Play the character.
It does interest me. Poirot has got... how many 50 stories or more that Agatha Christie wrote, like between short stories and full-on novels.
By far her most prolific character, yes.
Yeah, one she kind of grew to resent over the years because he is so unrelenting in his pursuit for justice, and he's so black and white and straight-laced and kind of a dick.
Yeah, which makes this movie really interesting.
Yeah, but I love his quirks because he's very polite, but he's also very...
arrogant.
Arrogant to... say the word OCD is
an understatement. Yeah. there's a lot that makes the character really interesting.
Yeah.
And it's funny because while I was watching, I'm like, I've read Agatha Christie novels when I was younger, but when I was younger, I always found her very pedantic, right? Mm. I didn't really enjoy the Agatha Christie novels, except for, I think, 10 Little Indians was the only one that I really remembered enjoying. But now that I've watched this, I'm like, I think I might need to go back and read some Agatha Christie and see if I enjoy it more as an adult than I did as a teenager.
Yeah, you know, even as a teenager, I always meant to read some Agatha Christie stuff. And it was always like Murder of the Orient Express, and certainly was already pretty popular by the time I was a teenager. It was, I mean, I think that it's safe to say that was her biggest novel. I mean, it's certainly the one everybody knows the title of, even if they've never read it.
Exactly. That and Death on the Nile.
Death on the Nile, yeah.
Which Ronnelly is now working on. They set it up at the end of the movie.
They do, but it was greenlit recently, so we are getting a sequel to this new Kenneth Branagh version of the character.
Yes.
It's funny, when I was watching the special features for that particular film, they said we wanted a younger Poirot who could do a little more physicality despite having his cane, which is something in the novel, which is funny because technically he's actually the right age for the character, who's in his 50s to 60s in the novels. And then we have Albert Finney in 74, who they had to do a lot of makeup on because he was only in his 30s.
Yes. I was about to say, Finney was younger than at the time when he made the movie than Branagh was when he made this one.
Yeah. Right?
But Finney played a very different Poirot. There's some really noticeable differences between the two performances. I mean, as there should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of what came after Orient Express 74 for television and whatnot, especially that long-running series on ITV in Britain, I think took more from the Albert Finney performance. Up to this point, Agatha Christie was really not happy with most of the portrayals of her characters and her stories on screen, and was very reluctant to even give up any more rights to her novels, but friends of the family, that sort of thing, that were tied to the producers of the 74 film kind of convinced her. And this is actually one of the films that she changed her mind on and really enjoyed, which was just a few years before her passing away.
Yeah, her final comment on it was, the only thing that she didn't like about the movie was Poirot's mustache. It wasn't the best mustache in Europe.
Oh.
And, you know, Finney's mustache was nothing compared to Branagh's.
Nobody's is.
Like, that is a stellar freaking mustache.
That thing is epic proportions. They kind of did this double mustache thing, because there's two flares on it,
and
it wraps around his face. It is. They took something very literally from the books when that inspired this mustache, because obviously, I mean, a big film with a big budget, they're going to work through a lot of different designs, but it was described in the books as being very majestic, the best of mustaches. And it made it sound like there was more than one.
Yes.
So that's what they did.
Yeah. They did a great job. And there's a funny bit when, because in both movies, there's a scene where Poirot is wearing the mustache protector. Mm-hmm. And in Poirot's mustache protector, there's a little mustache inside the mustache protector because he's got the double mustache.
Well, because it needs so much to perfection.
Yes.
So
yeah.
The fact that they didn't do it later when he was in his berth and kept getting woken up just before the murder. And before I get too far into this, we are talking about a murder mystery. If you haven't seen these films or read the book, please go back and do that, because I don't want to ruin a murder mystery for you. I normally don't warn people about that, but I'm going to do it this time because it is a murder mystery, and I'd like you to keep the mystery, but, I mean, we spoil every movie on this show, and we hope you have enough common sense to go watch the movie beforehand, or at least have knowledge about it.
Yeah, and if you don't care, keep listening.
Yeah, and if you don't care, keep listening. But, yeah, it did bother me in the Branagh movie that we see that early on when he's sharing the berth with McQueen, and then is moved to his private berth, and then he's doesn't have any of that stuff on.
And they do play that up in the 74 version, because there's every time that
he's wearing that stuff during the murder.
Yeah, because every time he pokes his head out, you see him wearing the mustache protector and the ridiculous head thing to protect his hair.
Yeah. Because
they can't shower, right?
Yeah.
So, or properly clean themselves with, so that's how he protects his hair and keeps himself tidy while traveling, obviously.
Yeah. There's actually a cutscene in the Branagh thing with his nightly ritual of making sure everything's perfect on the stash. And he's even got like four clocks in this little case that he dings all at once. And I'm like, I don't even know what any of this means. I guess that's why you cut it.
Yes. Yeah. If it doesn't make sense with the story. And it's funny, we've talked about my feelings about Michael Douglas before, where I enjoy every movie I see him in, but for some reason I don't like him, right? Mm. That's the same way I feel about Branagh. He's so good every time you see him. Mm-hmm. But something about him, I just, like, it's like, oh, it's Branagh. I just don't seem to want to care about his movies. But then when I watch them, I'm like, wow, that was really good.
It's because he always brings a passion to the material. Yeah. Like, I don't think generally he picks something that he's not passionate about, at least not in more recent years. I mean, he does, like, every now and again, a Thor or something, you know. You got to take the commercial ones that allow you to do all your Shakespeare stuff, because that's a little tougher draw to the masses these days.
It is. And
despite his doing really great, wonderful jobs on those.
He does, and he's got his own Shakespearean theater company, and a lot of his cast comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of his smaller players are from his Shakespearean theater company.
There's a lot of stage actors in the original film as well, the Sidney Lumet film. Lumet, I should say. I'm mispronouncing it. He had kind of equally dived into big screen actors of the 70s and kind of, I think, Sean Connery was the first person to sign on because they'd worked several times before at that point, and he was arguably one of the biggest actors of that era.
That was the rationale. If you get the biggest star, the rest will come.
And certainly did. But it's funny, when they actually got everybody together and they did table reads, and they'd be like behind their scripts going, I could barely hear them. It's because the stage actors were in awe of the screen actors, and the screen actors were in awe of the stage actors. So they were all very intimidated by each other, which I thought was an amazing anecdote.
That is really kind of fun. I can see that, though, right? Because, I mean, you have film actors who are bigger than life, and you see them on big screens, and they're in the magazines, and they have all this exposure. But I can see how film actors, especially film actors who have no theater experience, would be in awe of these theater actors who do it live every single night, which I think is a far greater art form, because you do. You have to remember all your lines. You don't get cues. Well, you do. You can, but usually, if you're a professional, you don't need them. So
several of these actors were even doing plays at the time. I don't know if you know this, but Albert Finney was simultaneously doing a play while filming. And sleep was a luxury that they just couldn't afford. So what they would do, they'd pick him up from his home in his pajamas, careful not to wake him up, transfer him via ambulance to the set, and do as much pre-makeup work as possible, because they had to make him look older while he was sleeping, which also says, wow, that guy's a heavy sleeper.
Yes. Or he had pharmaceutical help.
Not going to say one way or the other.
Given that Finney lived as long as he did, I don't think that he did. Mm-hmm. He abused much.
Yeah, yeah. He only recently passed away, and when I chose this film, it certainly wasn't with the intent to celebrate Albert Finney, but it certainly was in the back of my mind, and it was just like, yes, okay, here's a great film that just happens to fall at this right time to honor. What a great actor he really was.
He really, really was. And I'm sad to say this was not one of my favorite performances by him.
It took me a little bit to get eased into it, but I think because I was so unfamiliar with Poirot and how kind of fundamentally ridiculous he is.
My issue with it, I mean, I loved the first scene where you see him, where he's kind of waiting for the boat, and he's all hunched up, and he's very, very quirky. I love that, and he kind of lost that through the rest of the movie, like that really overt quirkiness. I mean, it's still there, but not as noticeably. And I found that his delivery sometimes was so mumbly in this movie that I had trouble understanding what he was saying.
Well, sleep deprivation probably. Yeah.
And that does explain it. Right?
But, I mean, that final scene. It was amazing. My God.
Absolutely, yes.
Fucking 8 pages of dialogue just over and over and over again. I mean, and shooting in these tight quarters and cabins, basically reconstructions of these cabins was... So having to do it over and over again, and that's got to be a trial on the other actors as well. Not only do they have to sit through this massive speech that he's making, but they have to be looking engaged and interested while sitting still.
Yes.
Through that whole thing over and over and over again. That had to have been a really difficult scene to shoot.
You know, and
I mean, at least for the actors,
certainly, yeah, because they're professionals though, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it comes back to my feelings on the differences of the endings of these two movies, because I found, like, I enjoyed both. Like, don't get me wrong, both of them were great for different reasons.
Yeah.
Right. I found the ending of the original was very serious and stolid, and I found the reactions in the remake far more poignant. Like, emotionally, I reacted to the way they would have been feeling at the time a lot better in Brana's remake. Like, he captured something there that was missing for me in the original.
You know, and I actually felt kind of opposite there. Like, they felt like a stunned crowd that, okay, I've presented your option, solution one, which is basically all this evidence that has been faked for his amusement. And the second one is the reality that's been pieced together about this murder that happened 5 years prior and everybody's connection to it. And the murder that happened on the train was this murderer from 5 years prior. And he manages to piece it all together in a way where they're like, okay, now what next? And I felt like Michelle Pfeiffer's character really disrupts from that drama and in some ways. But, I didn't feel it was as intensity of that moment as much in the second film. But in a way, you do feel the grief of the characters more.
That's the point I was trying to make. They're both really good endings.
Yeah.
I love the clinical ending of the first one. And you're right, the shocked feel that you get from everybody who's involved. It's like, we can't believe he figured this out kind of feel, mm-hmm. right? But the way that they portray it in the remake, Pfeiffer's character reveals a little bit before they get to the actual breakdown of what actually happened. And it sets it up for a more emotional ending, or usually the grief and mm-hmm. the poignancy of what happened to all these people and why they reacted the way they did. Right, so it's they're very different, and they're both very, very good. It's just I felt more emotionally connected to the ending of the remake.
Yeah, and whereas I actually thought I liked the ending on the original more, but I think the way Branagh breaks up the interviews and moves them around to different locations in the 2017 was far more engaging than
it improved the
constant
pacing.
Interviews and pacing and talking heads that we got through most of that movie. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not boring, but it can become tedious at times.
Yeah, and it's easy to sort of lose focus on it.
Yeah,
periodically, and that did happen to me a couple times when I was watching the original. Whereas when I was watching the remake, I never really lost focus, even though I knew the story already.
Yeah, and that's funny. I didn't. I thought I did before I started these movies, and I'm like, wow, I guess I'm just like most people were. Yeah, I know Agatha Christie wrote this novel called Murder on the Orient Express that involved a lot of people and a murder mystery on a train, but it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go
at all.
And I actually worry about Branagh's doing a brand new franchise and starting with this particular story because it's so different than your traditional murder mystery, which is usually driven by either revenge or personal gain. This is driven by grief.
Yes.
The story. And because of its uniqueness, moving into some of the other territory later on, that feels a little more trope-ish. But, I mean, let's face it, Agatha Christie invented the tropes.
She did,
so,
to a certain extent.
But I feel like it might come back and start feeling a bit tired by going to some of the other ones that do follow the tropes more. But then again, I don't know which ones are good and which ones aren't. So.
Nor do I. Like I said, I've never really got into Agatha Christie, but I am going to start reading some of her stuff and see if I enjoy it more as an adult. But I would just go back. One of the other things about this movie that is very different from the rest of Poirot's stuff is he moves into that gray territory that he doesn't normally do, from my understanding, is because of the nature of this crime, he has to make a decision.
Yeah, that's the nature of his character. He is very much a
right or wrong,
justice must be served.
Yes.
And that is his character. He's very proper. He's perfect attire. I wouldn't say he's a dandy because he tends to wear darker clothes and things like that, but he's very clean, very kept. He likes even numbers and perfect eggs.
And there's a great bit at the beginning of the movie and at the end where he asks someone to straighten their tie. Right?
Yeah.
Like he likes things in their place.
Yeah. Yeah. So for him, this is probably a real personal struggle.
Yes.
Where it fundamentally has to change his worldview. And maybe that's something Branagh will pull into and make changes down the road, because he does make changes in his film.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm going to run the original trailer before we get too into it, because I need to get into this huge cast. And then we'll talk some more about the original and, we'll get there.
We will get there.
It is a long ride on this train.
Choo-choo.
The city is Istanbul. The time is the 30s. The people are famous.
Monsieur Hercule Poirot, the famous?
Precisely.
Famous and infamous. Some are conspicuous by choice. Some are insignificant by nature. Others are incognito by right.
And the Orient Express, how is?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're in distinguished company. Moreover, you're in dangerous company. For you're about to join Hercule Poirot, the international detective, no less, in the most celebrated whodunit ever conceived by the mastermind of Agatha Christie.
I beg of you, you must solve the mystery.
How did you know it was a man?
Because I've enjoyed very warm relationships with both my husbands.
Did you leave your room?
Nay, not till morning, in my bedgown.
He had the means to do it.
It was found in an ashtray by the dead man's bedside.
Then someone planted it there.
He did it. The butler did it.
Seems like I'm kind of incriminating myself.
Not now. Not now. When it's all over, when it's behind us, then.
When what was all over, Miss Devon?
Am I to be accused of hiding it in my suitcase?
My life has been threatened, Mr. Poirot. And I can show you this.
Starring Albert Finney, Lauren Bacall, Martin Balsam, Ingrid Bergman, Jacqueline Bisset, Jean-Pierre Cassel, Sean Connery, John Kielgood, Wendy Hiller, Anthony Perkins, Vanessa Redgrave, Rachel Roberts, Richard Widmark, Michael York. So many stars. Together, they comprise the most entertaining ensemble who ever gathered to play their part in murder.
All right, that was Murder on the Orient Express, 1974. All right, so this was based, obviously, on the novel by Agatha Christie. The screenplay was by Paul Den, who wrote Goldfinger in 1964, and a whole bunch of Planet of the Apes movies.
Yes. I was actually expecting a connection to the writer, but I couldn't find one.
Nope, neither can I. But we have done a Sidney Lumet movie before, and that was Episode 75, Network. And he's also done classics like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. He actually credits Murder on the Orient Express for his ability to do Network. He says he couldn't have done Network without having done Murder on the Orient Express, because he learned to take a very dark subject matter and present it still with a light tone. And that is something he learned how to do on this movie.
Yeah, I can see that. I can totally see that.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I watched this movie and I was like, it's such a serious subject. Mm-hmm. And he's got that lighter tone, but the performances aren't all that light. Like, none of the performances are particularly light except for the crazy doctor.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody else is very serious. And then in Rana's remake, which we'll get to, I'm sure, as we talk about, but the performances are lighter.
It, yeah, it
but
does
the
feel,
story feels darker. It's really interesting.
It is. For such a bright big movie. I mean, both of them are big movies. In a small space. Yeah, Sidney Lumet. I mean, part of why he did such an immensely recognizable cast for 1974 is because it's such a big cast movie. So he wanted the characters to be more easily recognizable right away, and if you put famous actors in those parts, and it's going to be tough to draw big actors into small parts. I mean, unless you're Sidney Lumet and you have Sean Connery to attract everybody else.
But. And he was a total bait and switch, because he's like the first person you see on screen after the backstory, right?
And it's a fairly small part.
It's a hugely small part.
But they're all small parts.
They are all small parts except for Poirier.
Yeah, they all
do. He's got quite a prominent role in the movie because he's sort of with...
Yeah, they change his name to Bianchi in this movie, but which was part of it. If he's also not Belgian, then they have a reason not to speak Belgian to each other.
Yes.
That's why they did it. Then it forces them to speak English. I'm like, or you just don't mention it, like Prana did.
Yeah.
But okay. Okay, so this movie, immense cast, let's get to it. Albert Finney, of course, is the titular character of Hercule Poirot. Lauren Bacall, from most famous for probably The Big Sleep. I mean, Albert Finney, who just passed away, he's been in lots of stuff, but probably most modern audiences would remember him from The Big Fish and Aaron Brockovich.
Yes, yeah.
So Laura McCall was Mrs. Hubbard, probably the next main character in the film. Ingrid Bergman won an Oscar for Greta, despite being offered a bigger part of Princess Dragomirov. She just like, no, this character is more interesting to me. And Sidley Met, really, he wanted her in his movie so bad. He even said in the special features of the film, he's like, if she wanted to play Poirot, I would have let her. Because it's Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, that's a coup, right?
Yeah.
Especially because she was already kind of at the twilight of her career.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So to get her to work, and I think that might have partially informed why she wanted to do less as well.
Yeah.
Because she was reaching the end of a luminous career.
Well, she obviously made a good choice.
Yes.
Of course, I mentioned Sean Connery. I mean, Ingrid Bergman, by the way, famous for Gaslight and Casablanca. Yeah. Like, holy shit stuff. Sean Connery, we've talked about several times on the show. Episode 34 was the first time of Thunderball. 129, we covered Highlander. And
episode 47 with High Noon and Outland.
There we go. I'd missed that one. Martin Balsam played Bianchi. He was in Psycho and Cape Fear. Not the only person in this movie in Psycho.
No. I will be talking about him again, as mentioned, Cape Fear. And he's also in another remake, a movie that's been remade. And he's actually in both Cape Fears.
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah.
Jacqueline Bisset's in this movie. We talked about her in episode 155, at least briefly, which was the movie we covered, Casino Royale.
That was the one I missed.
There you go. Jean-Pierre Cassel was Pierre. He's been in things like Predaporter. John Gielgud was Bedos. He's been in Arthur and Gandhi. Lots of big stuff. I mean, most of these people have been in big stuff. Wendy Hiller was Princess Dragomirov. She was in The Elephant Man. Anthony Perkins, who pretty much got put in this part because it's the same part, was in Psycho. Obviously, we all know him from Psycho.
Yes.
Which also was remade. But I thought it was interesting that he also had a mother who passed away. Yes. That he was obsessed about.
Yes, and I wasn't sure if you caught that, because I actually laughed out loud.
I did too. Yeah. I'm like, was this on purpose?
I'm sure it was.
Because, I mean, Psycho was 1960, so that was like 14 years prior.
Yes, right. But I could see Lumet making that little nod to Hitchcock just through a little bit of dialogue, right?
It seemed very obvious to me, at least now.
Yes.
So, I mean, I never made mention about it in the special features, but I mean, come on. But that had to have been the purpose of that. Vanessa Redgrave was in Atonement and all sorts of great stuff. She was Debenham. Rachel Roberts was Hildegard. We'll probably talk about her again as well, because she was in When a Stranger Calls, which I do believe has also been remade.
I think you're correct.
Richard Widmark, who played Ratchet, has been in things like Coma, which I actually think we might cover at some point. It might be a good one to remake.
You've never done a Crichton film, so...
No, and The Alamo. Michael York, we've definitely covered. This was a very popular episode, episode 44, Logan's Run.
Yep, I didn't miss that one.
I didn't think you would. Colin Blakely was Hardman. He was in Dogs of War. And George Kolaris was the Doctor. He's been in things like Papillon and Citizen Kane.
Oh, we'll be doing Papillon too.
Maybe.
It was recently remade. So.
Oh, there you go. I did not know that. And Dennis Quilly was Fascarelli. So that was the main cast. This movie was budgeted, because it's a UK film, £1.5 million. Guess that's about $2 million American, roughly. And it had a box office of $35.7 million, so it was a big hit.
Yes. You can't go wrong with this cast.
No, right. No.
Right. I mean, I don't think that Finney himself was that well known when this movie came out, but I'm pretty sure this is what put him on the map as far as being a film actor.
I think as an international one.
Yeah.
I think, and yeah, he, like I said, he was doing a lot of stage at this time as well, but he was probably more known in the UK for sure. I mean, most of this cast was British,
yeah.
But it's really broke a lot of this cast out. I mean, Sean Connery was already there, but a lot of this cast,
obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, because yeah, if you look at Finney's body of work prior to this, like, he'd only been in two or three films prior to this. And then this obviously was like his, I don't want to say it was his first leading role, because I wasn't familiar with his first few films, but I suspect this was sort of his breakout film role.
Mm-hmm.
But he was quite prominent in theater at the time as well.
Yeah, I mean, this movie got several nominations, and of course, Ingrid Bergman won the Oscar for her part in the movie. But you think about the entire cast and the amount of Oscars and nominations that have been won by this cast,
yes,
over the years. Wow.
It is pretty astounding, actually.
Yeah.
When you talk about a marquee cast, especially from the 70s, this is pretty much it.
Yeah. And Agatha Christie, she got her inspiration from this, from the Lindbergh case.
Oh, clearly.
Clearly.
Yeah.
That would have just been a year or two prior. She probably started writing this story just a few months after that.
Because it's set around the right time frame, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, yeah, it was between World Wars I and II, so... And it's clear that it's part of the theme of the movie is that there's that military connection all the way through the movie as well, right? With the colonel and with both colonels, really.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In the remake, Brana does away with that device a little bit.
Yeah, he kind of combines Sean Connery's character in with the Doctor.
Yeah.
Because this is the Orient Express and it has such a long travel road with the diversity, he intentionally puts a lot of diversity into his cast, which sometimes does away with characters and adds new ones or makes some fundamental changes to those characters.
And that character is the one that changed the most for me. I mean, one, because they combined the Doctor and the Colonel into one character.
Yeah.
With a connection to, what's the young girl's name, Kimmy?
Oh, the child that went missing?
Yeah.
Daisy.
Sorry, I knew it was something cute like that.
Armstrong.
Daisy Armstrong. But yeah, Colonel Armstrong's was a heavy influence on our Doctor character in the remake. He was a military doctor, though, not a colonel like he was in the original, because there were the two different branches of the army in the original. Right? You had the Indian and the British divisions, and they had very different terminologies, and they were peers rather than mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Like mentor-mentee, like they are in Brana's remake.
Yeah, with Brana, he does recognize the separation of classes as well as minority races within his film, and the fact that the Doctor is in a relation with a white woman that they have to kind of keep secret because of that time, and the rare fact that he's in a position of privilege.
Yes, he's a doctor in a time where people of color would not normally have that opportunity.
Let alone be able to have the opportunity to get the education to be that.
Right. And if it weren't for Colonel Armstrong, and it's a beautiful device.
It is, yeah.
It's a really great device and really well written. But yeah, if it weren't for the Colonel, the Doctor never would have gotten the opportunity.
Yeah, there's another one was Ingrid Bergman's character of Greta was, she's a very religious zealot. Also, again, everybody's tied to the Armstrong family in one way or the other. She would have been, what do they call that position? The matron? The the one that basically raises the child.
Yeah.
The governess.
The governess, that's right.
Thank you, the governess. They changed that to Penelope Cruz as Pilar Estravados.
And by far the weakest performance in the remake, as far as I'm concerned.
And I get the feeling that, I mean, it wasn't just for diversity, but she is a character from another Agatha Christie novel. I don't know if she was this kind of character, though, but it does make me wonder if her character is going to show up again within this perceived franchise that he's building with Paul
Rudd. Brana's Christie universe?
Yeah.
Right. It'll be interesting to see. I'm a big fan of Penelope Cruz, don't get me wrong, but this was probably one, and maybe it's because of how little screen time she got, the character felt a little flat to me.
Yeah. There are some characters that I thought really shone in the original, didn't shine as much in the Bronagh movie.
Yeah, because the
character... Bronagh's definitely given more time than anybody else.
Well, for sure. But yeah, the governess in the original, I found her really engaging. Mm-hmm. I found her very, very engaging, and I was actually really interested in her and finding out more about her. Right? I think it's because of the way they wrote her overt religious sort of focus. You understand that she's really damaged, but you don't know why yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so when you get to the reveal, it all comes together, and you have a lot of empathy for her, right? Because of everybody on there, she feels the most responsible for what happened.
Yeah, it changed everything about her life.
Exactly, and you really feel that when you get to that reveal in the original, whereas you don't feel that for her as much in the remake. Which is funny because I feel the ending of the original or the remake is more emotional, but this is the one place where it didn't.
Yeah, there's so much performance put into the characters because they're portraying characters for Poirot that aren't necessarily who they are.
Exactly.
So it gets very confusing at times.
It does. And I mean, when you get right to Ratchet, who's also performing a role that he doesn't want anybody else to know about, right?
Yeah. And like nobody on that train, or at least this particular car,
is who they said they are.
Yeah. Not a single goddamn one of them. It gets really confusing with the Defoe character.
With the Pinkerton character,
The Pinkerton character in both films. I never quite was able to wrap my brain around either one of them quite properly. And Hubbard confused me a little bit, too, this famous actress that I assume had been retired for a while.
And had gone into seclusion.
I mean, if you think this movie takes place in 1935, she probably would have been a prominent actress in the silent era.
Or theater
even, which means it's not like they had the internet, so not as many people are going to be aware of what she sounds like if they didn't go to the theater, and if she was a silent film actress, they had no idea what she sounded like. She's grown older. Physically has changed. She's wearing a wig as well. It's probably a lot easier to have that anonymity in the 30s, but certainly you couldn't probably do that now.
No, not even as a theater actress.
Yeah.
So even if she was just theater,
yeah,
people wouldn't necessarily recognize her unless they'd seen her on stage.
Yeah.
And theater actors never look the same off stage. Never.
Yeah. And that's something that I think people, even with the novel, had the biggest logical leap. And I'm like, and 1930s, it's not that big of a leap.
No, it's not like the world's connected like it is now.
No.
So it certainly would be a lot tougher to pull off that kind of device in our current connected age. And I mean, even in the remake, Brana kind of acknowledges that by having her wear a wig.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I really enjoyed Michelle Pfeiffer's performance in that, because she played up sort of the widowed woman who's kind of looking for her next husband, but he has to be the right husband kind of thing, right? And she plays up her sexuality quite a bit, right? Which is the antithesis to who she really is, because she's utterly broken.
Yeah, no, she's definitely putting on airs. I mean, this wasn't part of the plan, was to put on this kind of production, because they didn't know Poirot was going to be on the train.
No.
I mean, I felt in the original film, Poirot makes some logic leaps that are tremendous. He knows a lot of details that I wouldn't think he would know. I mean, despite having been on the train and being asked to solve this murder for the owner of the train system, so it could be solved before they get to the other side and not arrest the wrong people and cause a lot of chaos or controversy for this train line. So he's asked Poirot to do this. Now, Brodig solves this by saying he had asked to been looked into the murder, it all kind of run its course by the time he got the correspondence, so never fully became involved in the case of the Armstrong's child going missing and then ultimately found dead. And you would think it's revenge, but it's for these people on this train who've planned to be on this train with this person, and it's really well orchestrated by Hubbard.
Beautifully orchestrated.
And all these people have been impacted, and it's not a vengeance thing. It's the only way they can deal with their grief of what happened. It wasn't just this baby that died, but the mother later dies in
childbirth.
Well, because of a miscarriage.
Yes.
The maid committed suicide.
Because she was accused.
The husband committed suicide. The maid was arrested because she was accused.
And then committed suicide.
Yeah. So one other person that died, they mentioned in the original that I cannot remember. But I do believe it was five people whose lives were impacted. And in some cases, these characters were like the brother of the maid, or
the girlfriend, or the boyfriend of the maid.
Yeah. Or because of the ties to the male Armstrong in the war, or
ties to
sisters
Armstrong
via the count and countess.
Yes. And then McQueen's character in the original
godmother of the child.
Yeah. And then you have McQueen, who saw Mrs. Armstrong as a surrogate for his own mother.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, going back to Anthony Perkins and the creepy.
mother.
And they changed that a little bit in the remake. And I actually like the way they did that. Again, just to give you some variants, so that if you had seen the original, it still felt like a different movie. Right? Josh Gad's McQueen was very interesting.
How good was he? Oh, my God. I was like, when I was going through that cast list, I'm like, one of these things is not like the other.
And then he blows you away again,
and,
right?
Well, yeah. And then you see him be cute character in Beauty and the Beast, and he's likable and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if he's right for this movie. And I'm like, whoa, who are you? where have you been?
It's
adds just a little bit of gruff, and he sounds like he's out of the era. He's so good.
Yeah, he's one of those underrated actors that is finally starting to get his due, I think.
Obviously was recognized by Brada. Yes. He's like, no, this guy's got it.
Yeah, and he does. He genuinely does. Like,
he does.
Right, when he breaks down, when he's telling the story about his father, again, and that's where I connected with these characters a little bit more, because most of them, not all of them, but with McQueen's character, I felt more connected to Gad's McQueen than I did to Anthony Perkins' McQueen.
Yeah.
Anthony Perkins' McQueen was just creepy.
Yeah, especially when they do the psycho bit, then it's like, all right, now all I'm seeing is the psycho character now. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
So that little nod almost did a disservice to the character, because it really popped me out of his character.
Yeah, and he's in the original, he's of the group of people who are... Yeah.
I'm sure it was meant to elicit a bit of a chuckle from the audience.
It was, but it did kind of pull you out from that character a little bit.
It does.
And he gets quite a bit of screen time after that, too. I think of all of the supporting characters, he seems to get the most screen time. Next to Bianchi.
Well, and Hubbard as well. Yeah, I mean, Bianchi and the Doctor are there for every interview. Yeah. I really liked, like, at least for the first three or four interviews, it's like, oh, he did it. The butler did it.
Yeah.
Or it was like instantly, like, no, he did it. Yeah. No, he did it.
Yeah, a lot of finger pointing, yeah.
Which was funny, but I'm glad they only did it three or four times, because it would have gotten tired if it happened every single time.
Yeah, it would have been the running joke that started to run flat.
Yeah. Even with the interviews being back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back, the performances carry you through them, because that can get really tiresome too. But
yeah, and there's times where, like I said, you kind of like, where at least I was watching it, and it was easy to get distracted by little things, because there is so much dialogue, and it's, I mean, I didn't miss anything, but there are times where I'm like, okay, I'm getting a little,
I was starting worn. To get a little worn out by it too, but I was also noticing some things that Lumet was doing with the camera that I really appreciated. So as they're being interviewed, they're fairly traditional shots.
Yeah.
And then they'll switch when there's connections being made and some theories being thrown out by Poirot. And then he'll do a deliberate lens change during those moments to a wide angle lens in a very confined space, which gives you a distorted view.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's interesting, and unsettles the moment.
And you're right. That's exactly obviously what he was trying to do, and it worked. But again, and that comes to those, when I was talking about those little things that distract you, is instead of paying attention to the dialogue, you're paying attention to what he was doing in terms of visually.
Right.
And it's, you're not supposed to notice it. It's supposed, you're supposed to feel it. And that's.
Yeah. He's very good at making you feel things.
Yeah.
You know, the way he uses that lens and his camera shots. There's one shot in particular that I saw on the special features that was a very difficult one to do. And it didn't, because of the nature of the shot, it was initially when everybody had gone on the train. So you got this pulling back to the engine of the train. And so it's this pull back, and you get to the engine, and then it pushes forward to that light turning on, and then the engine pulls out. Because the actual Orient Express engine couldn't go very far. Most of the cabins have been torn up and retired to museums and whatnot, so they had pieces of it, and they had to recreate the rest. But because it couldn't really go very far, they really only could do this once. And they managed to do it in the first shot.
And then they never used it?
No, they totally used it.
Okay.
You're
talking about how they accomplished
it. That's how they accomplished the shot. And they just managed to get it. It was just like this faith in everybody. And you can imagine the cheering, having gotten it on and everything working perfectly the first time out. It was quite something. There's a few other wonderful bits about this movie, and some not so wonderful, but with the sound design, like during that moment, there's all this music and theme going on. And I don't know if it ages as well as it did then. Like, it's fairly majestic, and it carries on from that moment for about the first 20 minutes into the film, into the interviews. So it lasts, that whole piece of music lasts a very long time. But Lumet liked the music so much. Initially, there's all this train sound design that's happening. And the guy who was doing the sound design was a train enthusiast. He had every fucking sound of trains under the sun. And he had layered it all in and put it all in. Everything sounded wonderful and perfect and amazing. And then he had this music. And Lumet felt both were kind of conflicting with each other.
So he took out the train sounds.
He did. The guy was so upset he quit. Movies!
Yeah, you know, I kind of don't blame him. I get Lumet's decision, but at the same time,
the emotional impact of that. And he was trying to go for this big Hollywood feel, right? The clothes, despite trying to be period, had a little bit of modern flair to it. And that's something that carries on to Bronnings as well. They should feel 30s, but still feel modern, because it should feel slightly out of reality, like big Hollywood. It's the Agatha Christie world, but not the real world.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting. Where they get stuck in the snow, where they were shooting is very well known for having a lot of snow during that time, which I think was October of that year. And they get to the set, no snow, nothing. So the producer was like, okay, I'll call in and get a lot of snow being shipped in. And Lumet's like, no, I've already talked to God. He'll take care of it. But if you want to go through the expense of hauling in snow. So he did make the call to get the trucks, and it snowed like a motherfucker that night. The snow got the trucks hauling the snow stuck. That's how much snow there was.
That's some irony there.
Yeah. So those are just a few fun things I discovered in the special features I had to share with you guys, because I thought they were really amusing.
Trust Sidney Lumet.
And the one thing that I kind of liked, because he had a lot of stage stuff in his, and I didn't feel it quite had the same moment in the Bronagh, is they kind of get a curtain call at the end.
They do. And I didn't like it.
Initially it didn't, but then I got what he was trying to do. It does feel a little out of place. Like, it's like, well, we've been discovered, or at least it was a moment for them to let their roles fade off.
It was. And I saw what he was trying to do, but I just, it's part of why I like the ending of the remake just a little bit better, is it felt a little stiff and a little forced.
Well, and I felt he had some similar moments in his for different reasons, because he had that big long table, because they set something out outside of the train. They use the excuse of putting the derailed train back on the tracks, because it's on this precarious viaduct to add a little gripping realism and just
tension, yeah.
tension and a threat of maybe the train going over this big viaduct, and also gives you that chase sequence later.
Yes.
But near the end of the film, they got this big long table, and I don't know if you caught it, but the first time you see everybody lined up in this table, it's the fucking Last Supper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And like, I just had to roll my eyes. I'm like, this is a little too on the nose, dude.
Yeah, especially considering you've got 12 characters there too, yeah. Right?
Oh, and they were totally in the right positions, and it gives away the rest of who did what kind of moment.
To a certain extent,
if you pause that moment, you can pick out exactly who's what.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that was kind of intended to sort of say, were you paying attention?
Yeah.
Right? And having just watched the original, and it's a little easier for us.
Yeah,
it's a little more noticeable. But yeah, it was one of the moments there where I'm like, oh, Kenneth, that was a little heavy-handed.
Yeah, and to be honest, it popped me out so much that I just couldn't get into the rest of it, that last bit.
Yeah, and that might be why you didn't feel the same way as I did, right?
But, you know, where at least with the curtain call, it's right at the end. There's nothing really after that.
Yeah.
So it was fine, where I was like, I haven't even got the reveal yet.
Yeah.
And now I just don't care.
Yeah, especially considering that you know what the reveal is already. It's just that much easier to pull you out. But yeah, I can see, and that's probably why I found the ending a little more effective. Again, I don't want to say effective because they're both really good. I found that the ending of the original with the clinking of the glasses and the sort of the walk through was a little much, especially given the way that he walked you through the murder as part of the walk. Bronoff didn't do that with his, right? Like, where he didn't have every single person walk up and do their stabbing step by step by step by step. He didn't spoon feed the murder to you.
I kind of liked how methodical Sidney Lumet made that. Like, this guy's been drugged, and you don't know who's made that killing blow. Everybody gets one stab, and they say, what for?
Yeah.
This is for this. This is for this. They don't do that in the Bronig one. They all are kind of more in a crowd to take their moment, and it's more of a really impassioned,
it's more visceral. Yeah.
It's definitely darker and a little more vicious.
Yeah.
So, like, I think both scenes work for different reasons.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
you get the reason of grief in there, but it's laid out a little more in your face in the Lumet one, where it's more emotional in the Bronagh version.
Exactly, and I think maybe the reason I appreciated it the way Bronagh did it is because I had just literally the night before watched the original. So if I had to watch that again exactly the way it was done in the original, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much. And that's where this is a good remake. Mm-hmm. Is they're not giving you the original movie note for note for note for note.
No. Right?
They're making changes where they need to.
Yeah.
To make the story a little more compelling for a modern audience.
Yeah.
Right? And Bronagh did that exceptionally well.
I think so,
with
too.
With a few misses, but
for being basically a locked room story in a very confined and claustrophobic space, he manages to open it up somewhat by having a chase sequence on the aqueduct and doing interviews in different locations and walking the top of the train and having stuff going on in the tunnel. He manages to open it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And that does help somewhat with that claustrophobia, but I think maybe takes away from the tension of the story somewhat, because claustrophobia adds to the story.
It does. And I'm not sure that, well, that's part of it, but also I think it breaks up the monotony of those interviews a little bit.
So yeah, it's absolutely what that's for.
Yeah, and it worked in that sense, but I agree that by taking them outside of the train through parts of it,
mm-hmm.
did kind of break that feeling of the locked room a little bit.
Yeah. Right?
And then there's also the scene where there's the confrontation with the doctor in one of the cargo, like, it must be the luggage or cargo.
Yeah, thing. I
hated that. I hated it.
I didn't like it either. Yeah. I didn't like it either. At that point, I thought Daisy Ridley was giving a pretty good performance, and then suddenly taking the blame for the whole thing didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then the doctor comes out. I mean, they're obviously just trying to cover up the fact that they're having a relationship and protecting the other passengers.
And they're trying to give you a red herring. So if you don't know the story, or even if you do know the story, you're thinking, oh, well, he's changing it.
Bronagh is deliberately doing that by changing characters and changing some scenarios, because it is such a famous story, you already think you know how it's going to go. So he is trying to do that with mixed results.
Yeah.
I mean, the original film here, I'll give you the ratings here. The original film from 74 has an IMDb rating of 7.3 out of 10, while the Kenneth Branagh is a slightly less at 6.5 out of 10.
Still pretty respectable.
Pretty respectable and pretty close, I think. And I do think they're both fine films, by the way. I liked them both. I think I like the original just a little bit more for some different reasons. And it's nice that we're split on this, to be honest. I kind of enjoy that. Rotten Tomatoes, on the other hand, the critics really adore the 74, 91%. And the audience score is 79%. Part of me thinks it's just less people have watched it. But
I come down to modern audiences again, really, and that's where I think that we differ for a little bit, is I do tend to gravitate more towards modern cinema versus classic cinema, right?
Well, yeah, Rotten Tomatoes for the 2017 is 59% critics score and 54% audience score, which is, I found very interesting because I didn't think it was that much of a divide. It makes me not want to say Rotten Tomatoes scores because they seem to just be completely out to lunch a lot of the times. I don't think that it's that much different. I mean, in my opinion, yes, I think the Kenneth Branagh is slightly inferior, but it's just as pretty to look at.
Oh, for sure. And
if not more so.
I don't know if we're split so much, because I still think that the 74 is a superior film overall.
Okay, I think we're probably fairly close.
Yeah, there are parts of the modern remake that I enjoyed more than I did in the original, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Right? It's hard to put into words how these two films compare to each other, because they're both so strong as independent films.
Well, right? Maybe if I run the trailer, you'll be able to put that into words.
There we go.
Would you mind if I join you?
You're the world-famous detective,
Hercule Poirot.
Avenger of the innocent. Is that what they told you in the papers?
And you are innocent?
You're fun.
A passenger has died. He was murdered. The murderer is on the train with us now. And every one of you is a suspect. So, let us catch a killer.
A man was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night.
You are certain it was a man?
I know what it feels like to have a man in my bedroom.
What did you think of the dead man?
You leave her out of this.
Did he have enemies?
Pick a number.
The real killer is right here. One of you people.
We're surrounded by lies.
I'm sleeping here, where everyone can see me. And I can see everyone.
Who takes up the knife?
Cannot trust a one. Another one?
All right, that was the 2017 Kenneth Branagh, written, directed, produced, starred. Well, okay, he didn't write it, but he did a lot on this movie. He was producer, director, and star of the film. And we've seen him in lots of stuff, lots of Shakespeare stuff. He's going to be in the upcoming sequel, Death on the Nile, slated for 2020. Upcoming Artemis Fowl later this year.
A lot of the cast in this movie is in the Artemis Fowl movie.
I noticed that.
A lot of them.
I noticed that. He's also been like Hamlet, Thor, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He's directed those movies. So big, diverse, and very busy talents behind and in front of the camera.
He's actually one that I'd like to remake at some point. I'd like to remake Dead Again, which is a really great movie.
Hey, there's something we could do, yeah. The screenplay was written by Michael Green, who has been the showrunner for American Gods on Amazon, and wrote the scripts for Logan, Blade Runner 2049, and Green Lantern.
You know, I don't know if that was a script failing or a direction failing or...
That was a very busy movie.
Oh, yes, it was. That's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
On another show, perhaps.
Maybe another show. Yeah, it had a lot of problems, and I don't think you can put the blame entirely on a script, because there was definitely some choices that were made that weren't script choices. So,
or performances. Like, there's so much right with that movie that just ended up into an ugly mess.
Yeah. Movie was budgeted at $55 million and grossed $352.7 worldwide. That's why it's getting a sequel. Man, another big cast. Obviously, Kenneth Branagh was Hercule Poirot. Penelope Cruz, we just talked about, as a new character, Pilar Estravados.
Well, new old character, renamed character.
Yeah, renamed character. Willem Dafoe was Hardman. I don't really have to give you resumes for some of these people.
No.
They're so big, and you just saw Willem Dafoe in Aquaman. Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench. We've actually talked about her in episode 155, Casino Royale.
Yeah, I was going to say there's another Casino Royale reference there, yeah.
Which is kind of nice. She played the princess. Daisy Ridley has gotten some talk on here, because we've talked about the Star Wars movies over the years, and you can catch those in episodes 23 and 123 when we talk about Force Awakens and Last Jedi.
It's funny, when I was doing my research, I'm like, they're exactly 100 episodes apart. I didn't even realize
that. I didn't know that until I wrote this down. Yeah. I'm like, how the fuck did that happen? Leslie Odom Jr. was the Doctor, and you can see him in Red Tails. Josh Gad, we just said some wonderful things about him as McQueen. And we talked about him in episode 150, Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, we did.
Johnny Depp, who I actually thought did a very good gangster, but he's been in gangster movies before.
He has, yes.
He played the almost two on the nose Ratchet.
Yeah, I am hit and miss with Mr. Depp.
Especially lately.
But this one, I liked the original Ratchet so much better.
I mean, I really did like Depp in this, but I did too. He does. He comes off too obvious.
Yeah.
Where, you know, because he is trying to hide his past.
Yeah.
He doesn't do a very good job, but he comes off way too Italian mob.
Yeah.
It's a little heavy-handed, I think.
Yeah.
But we've talked about him before in our Nightmare on Elm Street, which was episode 112. Derek Jacobi, or Jacobi, depending on what part of the world you're in. I really like him. Normally, I see him as a villainous type of character because he's played the Master on Doctor Who. But I love just the cadence of his voice. But he's been in Gladiator and Gosford Park, and he played the butler, I guess, did it.
Yes. Yeah.
One of many who did it. But
it's funny. You know,
butler did do it.
Yeah, as I was going through both these castles, I'm like, I cannot believe that we don't have a connection with this actor. Right? And Jacobi was one where I'm like, I know we've talked about Jacobi before, and we haven't.
No. And he's got such a large body of work, and I adore him as an actor. I'm glad we finally got to talk about him. Sergei Polonin, who actually played Count Rudolf Adraini. He'd been in some movies before, but never actually had a vocal presence. He was a physical presence. He's an actual dancer. And I think this was the first movie where he had any kind of significant dialogue. Yeah. And you can see the dancer when he has that fight at the bar.
Which pissed me off.
It was a little extreme. I'm like, boy, this guy's got a temper.
Yeah, it was completely unnecessary.
It was extraneous.
Yeah, and that was one of the things about the remake that I didn't enjoy.
No, they kept the Count and Countess so segregated from everybody else for so long that you forgot they were there.
Because they gave them that diplomatic immunity thing and you couldn't interfere with them. And then adding the drug dependency with the barbitol, it was really, really obvious in the remake. This is, again, there's one of those moments where the movie kind of fell flat for me, was the way that they use these characters. It was a long time before you got to see them in the original as well. You get to see them briefly and then they disappear for a long time, just like Connery's Colonel as well, for that matter. Right? You don't see them on screen hardly at all. And then all of a sudden they show up and then you have this great bit of dialogue. But the dialogue didn't work as well because you have this really aggressive male character.
I mean, you do get some moments is when they're in the dining car and everybody's kind of there and Poirot's walking through. Like, you do see everybody together at times, but you often forget about the Count and Countess in this particular version.
Yeah, and there's a great opportunity, especially in the remake, because there's this great moment where the Count is showing these great moments of tenderness to the Countess, mm-hmm. right? Like, and I would have liked to see more of that in the remake because of her dependency and how broken she is. It's too little too late in the movie for that dynamic to really work well in context with the rest of the story,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it serves to the Count's motivation for his violence towards the Ratchet character, because he's the only one who's not directly involved with the Armstrong family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, he has no personal...
That's true. Yeah, his connection is through his wife.
And they were trying to establish that, but it just happened a little bit too late for me. It happened a little bit earlier in the original, where you understood his motivation for his actions in the whole crime.
Yeah, he's basically protecting her.
Yes.
Right. And covering for her. Marwin Kenzari was Pierre. He was the steward, I guess. The
steward, yeah.
Yeah. Lucy Boynton. And we'll talk about Marwin, by the way, again, because he was in the recent Ben-Hur, and he's going to be in the upcoming Aladdin as Jafar.
Oh, I'm interested to see him as Jafar. Yeah. I have not watched the trailers yet.
The newer one's much more enticing.
Okay.
And it's big and colorful, and especially when the songs, it's like, okay, I'm starting to buy this now. So that first one didn't really sell me, and I think most of the world felt the same way. So, but this new one's like, okay, this is looking good. This is looking a little more uplifting. It could be a good year for Disney again, because Dumbo's looking really good. That's coming out first, and Aladdin later this year, and also looking pretty slick. And then you got their Marvel movies on top of it, and I think three a Star Wars. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. So lots of stuff coming from Disney yet again. I think they're going to rule the box office for another year.
Disney is big brother.
Yeah, I think they are at this point. Lucy Boynton, who plays the Countess, another young actress, but in some great stuff. She was just recently in Bohemian Rhapsody and Apostle. And I talk about Apostle in 31 Days of Horror, so check out that episode.
Yeah. And it's funny that she's another actress where I'm like, I know we've talked about her before, but no.
No connection. That's why I mentioned, I'm like, well, I have talked about her briefly in 134.
So. Yeah, but it's just funny because there's the actors I know so well, and I was sure we talked about them before, but
yeah,
because they're that well known, right?
Well, Michelle Pfeiffer, we definitely have. She plays Caroline Hubbard, and we talked about her in episode 39, Lady Hawk, in episode 179, which was just two weeks ago, Hairspray.
And again, I don't think either of us realized that when we chose these movies.
No, not at all.
It was just a pleasant irony.
Yeah, we were just looking for something a little different. We wanted to watch a period piece for you guys. And just sometimes these things happen. Olivia Colman, who plays Schmidt, another good role. She wouldn't get nominated for this, but she would come and win an Oscar this year for a different movie, The Favorite. And of course, we all remember her from Hot Fuzz as well, if you don't know who she is. Tom Bateman, I thought, was really good in this movie, playing Bauk.
Yes.
And yeah, I don't know. He's playful, but can be serious at the same time. And almost, when you see him in this suit on the train, being all responsible, considering how he was the womanizer at the beginning of the movie, I'm like, is this a different dude?
Well, and I really enjoyed his portrayal of this character, because
me too.
He plays the lavish playboy until he shouldn't be. Right? Like, he enjoys his lifestyle, but he also takes his job very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I really enjoyed that. And for a guy with such a small body of film work, he was phenomenal.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I expect big things from this guy and very soon. I mean, being put in a big movie like this alone is going to certainly raise his cachet, much like it did other people in the original film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he's one of Brana's theater troupe players. He's one of the ones that came out of that. And he will be reappearing in Death on the Nile as well.
Yeah, because he is a reoccurring character within the novel. Yeah. So that's great. We get to see him again, especially in that role. I'm looking forward to seeing more of him. Manuel Garcia Ruffalo was Marquez, and that's our cast. So another big, expensive cast, but movie actually was fairly decently budgeted. They tried to do most of it in camera as best they can. I love how big and bright it looks. A lot of that has to do with being shot on 65mm. Yes. I mean, at a time when film's getting rare and you're already using a rare film stock, 65mm, I think there was only one processing place in the world, which was Los Angeles, and they had to make a new one, new processing place for that film for this movie in the UK.
Nice. I want to, speaking of this, the way this is shot, there's this, the first scene on the train when they show Paré walking through the train, that long, beautiful pan.
Paré? Puré?
I can't even remember the name.
Poirot.
Sorry. I don't know where the hell that came from.
I don't either.
I'm mixing up characters all of a sudden. But Poirot's character, where he's walking through the train, that long, beautiful pan all the way through it. Mm-hmm. It's like, that was just fantastic.
Are you talking about the one at the end when comes out of the train, like he's walking through the train, it follows him out of the train and up and down? I saw how that was shot, by the way.
No, and that one was beautiful too, but at the beginning of the movie,
when first that's a very good one. Yeah,
yeah, and because you show him, he interacts with every single person in the cast through that bit.
Yeah.
It's
a very impressive shot.
And it's a great introduction.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you get to see everybody, and that's something that's very important for both of these movies, is to get to see all these characters. And that's another reason why they keep casting big-name actors, is so you can really identify who's who. And thank you, because it helps.
It does help, yes.
I mean, a little less so in 74, because I'm not as familiar with those people, and they're not as recognizable to me, because I was one. Yeah. But certainly in the modern one, I recognized everybody pretty immediately.
Although I do have to admit that when I first saw Daisy Ridley, I started confusing her a little bit with Keira Knightley.
I did too, because they both like talk out of their teeth.
Yes, and they have similar structure.
But Boyd, like, just, she has, it was so easy to see her in that classic 30s look, and I'm like, man, you got some grace to you. Yeah. You know, seeing her in this movie, like, there are some clumsy scenes with her.
But that's not her fault.
It's not because of her, because I'm like, wow, she is really good in this, and I actually liked her better in this than I did in Star Wars.
Her initial banter with Brana was so well done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so well done. And you get lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was just amazing.
Yeah, this is the kind of movie that makes me really look forward to seeing what's next in her career beyond Star Wars. That's really not showcasing how talented she is. Yeah, she's getting lead parts because of Star Wars,
but I'd like to see a door opener for her, because she is far better than the material she's getting in the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, I think so.
I enjoy them, but but Star Wars movies have always been fluff.
Yeah, no, I think she's got great things ahead of her, and there's a certain caliber. Like, I see something in her that there could be some gold in her future.
Yes,
some little naked gold men in her future. I don't know. That is a prediction of mine.
I'm going to agree with you on that prediction.
I could be a statue. It just could be some weird dude.
It could be both.
Some weird dude who body painted himself holding a sword. But I'm going to lean towards the statue.
Yeah, and hope for that rather than the weird dude, because that's just creepy.
Either way, it's making the news.
Yes.
I mentioned another shot. It was near the end of the film where it's a very difficult shot to do. And I was watching how they did it, and it was a lot of practice involved, because it made me really feel bad for the camera guy. Because the only way to shoot it in this confined space that's moving out of the space, and there's cranes and stuff, it was to go handheld. With the 65mm camera, the only heavier camera I can imagine would be an IMAX, which would also be, I just cringe at the thought of going handheld with something like that. I've held 16mm and handheld, and they're pretty heavy, and like a Sony DSR digital camera, which was pretty heavy. I can't even imagine that thing, so that's some dedication there. And it's a long shot,
because it's
tracking out and walking backwards onto a crane that lifts up, comes back down, and then he walks off of it to continue following And it's like, oh, Jesus.
He must have had a guide as well to make sure he stepped in
the spots. Yeah. There's definitely people helping him and guiding him along to keep him safe.
Yeah.
Because the equipment's expensive and, you know, you don't want anybody hurt on set as well. But to do that multiple times, and you could tell by the end of it, like, oh, he's just shaking. Yeah. At least the camera's not, but there are parts of him that's just like, he's like, can we finish this now?
Yeah, because I can't even begin to imagine. And considering that it was handheld and how steady it was, mm-hmm. I mean, kudos to him as for the quality of work. I mean, there's a reason mm-hmm. that he's obviously getting jobs on films like a Brana film.
Yeah. Right? Another behind-the-scenes thing I want to share with you, because from both films, and it's a common thing we see in a lot of films, is this illusion of movement. You know, if you're shooting stuff on a scene in a train, you don't technically need to have that train moving. So what they did in the original film, they shot a lot of background, and then they had individual projectors for the windows, so it's all happening practically, so it's looking like the train is in movement, and each one was set about 2 seconds apart. And rather than reset it for the other side, if they had a reverse shot from the other side of the cabin, they had the whole car set on a crane and then lifted it up and reversed it, so everything would line up with the other windows.
That makes sense, because that car obviously could have, it was just mirror image, right? So just flipping it would work just as well, right?
Yeah. So, and just lift the car was a lot easier than resetting all of these screens that were being backgrounds for the film. Now, it's a little more complex in 2017, but again, they were thinking very similarly, where they went out, shot all the backgrounds they needed for this train ride. But instead of projectors, now it's big, long LCD screens on both sides. So they don't have to flip it anymore, but the set is still on a gimbal to give the sense of movement on track. And it really does feel like movement. That's the one thing about that, having to recreate all of that stuff, is it gives less for the actors to have to worry about, because it feels like they're on a train.
Yes.
And you have that sense of motion and movement. And, I mean, imagine if you're looking out these clear screens. He actually did two tests where they actually did run something along the set, and it was the actual background behind those windows. And then he did a test with the LCD screens and then asked the producers to pick which one is which. Couldn't tell the difference.
Nice.
So it tells you how our LCD screens have come a long way. And I mean, when you're shooting on 65mm, everything's going to be fairly true to the eye as well.
Yeah, no, and it looked great. And yeah, you do get that sense of movement. You forget, and that's, both movies did this successfully. You forget that they're in a stationary set
mm-hmm.
and that it's not really on a train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unlike the original set where, I mean, they were really kind of working in a confined space. There was a lot of shooting from different directions and shooting scenes over and over and over again, whereas they built these cars where in the new movie with flyout walls and roofs and things, so they could get cameras into spots they normally couldn't. The one, I don't know if you felt the original film, when they go into Ratchet's cabin and they find him dead, I feel that scene works better than what Bronick did, because he stays outside the cabin and we only hear what's going on from this bird's eye view at the top of the hallway. And it, man, I was just like, can we fucking go in there?
Yeah,
I mean, I know he saved it later for a flashback, but boy, did that bug me.
And I'm all with you on that, actually. That was one of the things I'm like, this doesn't feel right. It feels out of character for the character, and it just didn't work as well. I liked it when he went into there and discovered sort of all the clues on his own with the help of the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And the clues themselves felt far more staged in the remake, because they're sort of all piled up there together.
Yeah, they do look staged. But, I mean, even the characters, like, okay, well, here are all the clues that are here for my attention, and I think this is the only legitimate one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in both films, he says something very similar. There are too many clues. Like, there are too many clues for this crime scene.
Yes. Yeah,
he's onto it fairly quickly.
Yeah, and he just has, now he just sort of
sorting which one's which.
Yeah, which one's which, and how all these clues that aren't really clues are going to lead him to his killer anyhow.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I really like about this movie is all of these fake clues are actually really clues. Right. It's like these red herrings.
But they don't even realize that they are, because it's like, okay, well, if everything directs to people that could have done it, but all of them have these completely legitimate and ironclad alibis as well, then it's going to rule everybody out. But, you know, they're also giving everybody motives. So as he's digging into the real characters of who they are, these do wind up being actual clues, because that means everybody was here.
Yes.
Everybody.
Exactly.
And it couldn't have been just one person.
Yeah. There's one change as we talk, I do lean more and more towards the original as being a better film, because there's another bit that I really liked in the original with the stopping of the watch. The way that they handled that in the original was made more sense. It fed into the murder, and it felt more natural as a setup. Right? It didn't feel as fake as it did in the remake.
Mm-hmm. I didn't like that Hubbard was so hands-on and even takes a knife to the back for distraction.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know about this. Finding the knife in your cabin is one thing, but finding it in your back is another.
Yes. Yeah, there was a bit of an extreme there, and that did bug me as well. Really, Vrana's mustache, definitely superior. Performance, I did find Vrana's performance a little more understandable. I did find that Finney did kind of get lost in the accent a little bit, and
at times I thought it was a little heavy. Yeah. But at the same time, maybe felt a little more legitimate as a result, because you know, we do sometimes get lost in somebody's accents and like, what is he saying? And then he does switch to French at times, so
he does it, but I just found it more a little more engaging, just because I could understand everything that Bono was saying, whereas Finney, when he was getting kind of mumbly and maybe a little bit lost in the accent, I felt like I was missing something.
Yeah, I think the quirkiness and just the character of Poirot is well portrayed by both of them.
So absolutely. No question.
I think they're both very engaging and very easy to watch in those roles.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I have no slight on Finney's performance.
Finney's probably closer to what we imagine in the books as this more dumpy, egg-shaped, short dude. But you know, movies.
Yes.
Yeah. So Kenneth Branagh doesn't fit the description of the character, well, except the epic mustache.
Yeah, if I had gotten more of the Finney that I saw at the very beginning, where he sort of kind of pulled down into his coat and kind of antisocial almost, if I had been able to get more of that from Finney's performance, I think I probably would have enjoyed him that much more.
Well, I think as he gets more engaged, it kind of pulls him into the
like
world.
Like a turtle almost, yeah.
Yeah, it pulls him out of his shell. Because I don't know if that was the intention, but it certainly works in that regard.
And looking at it that way, I can see how it works. But I just still kind of gravitate more towards Brenna. Again, mostly because when he was speaking, I understood everything he was saying, and I didn't feel like I was missing things.
I felt the Branagh version felt more modern Hollywood to me.
To a certain extent, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But maybe the same can be said for Sydney's version.
The Hollywood of the time, yeah.
But, you know, like I said, I was 1 or 2 years old. Yeah. So it wasn't, that's not something I can make a proper comparison to. But it doesn't feel as Hollywood to me, but that's because I'm not familiar with what 70s Hollywood, as familiar with 70s Hollywood is.
Even though we've watched a lot of 70s Hollywood films.
We have, and when I think about it, I'm like, no, maybe it does fit.
Yeah, and it's no slight on Finney's performance, because it was still thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah. Right?
And I still think that the original was just a bit superior to the remake.
Yeah.
But when we talk about remakes, and we've talked about how often the remakes fail the original material. Mm-hmm. Recently, we've had a stretch of good luck where the remakes are comparable at the very least to the original movies.
Yeah,
right. The Hairspray a couple weeks ago, again comparable to the original movies. They made it something new without
Suspiria
again made it something new without taking away anything away from the original. And this one does that reasonably successfully as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I think these are both solid films. I think the IMDb ratings represent it fairly well. They're fairly close. I'm same of the mind, where I think the original is just a little bit better. It does some things a little bit better than the Bronig one, but I can also say that about Brana for certain aspects of the film as well. There are certain things he does better than the original film as well. But both him and Lumet are very good filmmakers with a very good eye, and they're both amazing films to look at.
Yeah. And I do want to give credit to Brana for his understanding of our modern audiences, because I suspect that some of the things that we saw in this wouldn't have happened if he didn't understand, like the breaks from the interviews, mm-hmm. because we, as modern audiences, tend to want to see a little more action with their drama.
Yeah.
And he does that very well. Aside from that chase scene with McQueen, which does pull you out of the enclosed claustrophobic feeling of the train, his moments where he breaks away from the interviews and changes the pacing just a little bit works really well to keep you engaged in the film.
Yeah, it is a very different audience, and our attention spans are very different from those of the 70s. So by giving us more to look at and more to see, I think he does accomplish that well. And maybe that resonates better with a little bit of a younger audience than us, but I think the material is going to resonate with everybody.
It should. It should. The story is so engaging.
I was so happy to see that it had a good box office, because it just shows that there's still life in these old characters.
And this type of movie, like, yeah. we don't see as many murder mysteries as we used to, where they're true murder mysteries.
Yeah.
Every murder mystery that comes out now is a fucking Bruce Willis film.
and honestly, yeah. you can...
Not literally, but figuratively, yes.
Yeah, and you can... Most modern ones you can figure out in the first 15 minutes. It bugs me. I thought I knew what this movie was, and I was very pleasantly surprised when we do get to the reveal. I'm like, and a little irritated at times, because it realizes how small of a box my world actually is. Because there were certain things that, man, maybe you just have to be a European to make some of these leaps, logic leaps that he's making. Because there's no way I would have come up with some of these things that he comes up with as a character. That's the wonderful world of Agatha Christie as
it,
well.
It really is. I mean,
she was a smart woman, and a whole lot smarter than me.
Yeah, or she just makes those leaps of... Probably.
Probably she was very worldly.
She was very worldly, yes, and maybe a little bit crazy.
I think we've probably mentioned on some episode, I seem to remember us talking about her disappearance time, and there are even movies about what might have happened during that time, some conjecture there.
Yeah, and that's all it is conjecture.
It is conjecture. She doesn't remember either. Yeah. Or claim to, but we'll never know now. So
never will, unless there's some secret diary somewhere that hasn't been found yet.
You know what? I think we've been on this train long enough.
Well done.
Thank you.
Chugga, 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 chugga.
I was really looking forward to this conversation, especially after watching these movies, and this was a great ride.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. I was, as always, when we go back into especially the 70s, because I know that their films tend to be long from about like 73 to about 79, 80. They just tend to feel a little longer than they need to be. This one did not.
No, I mean, the original movie does run 128 minutes, and it's only 10 minutes longer than Bronick's version.
And neither version felt overlong.
No.
Even with the slow bits in the middle of the original, with the interviews and the... But it's all storytelling, and it's so important.
Yeah.
Because it just shows how great... Lumet is at storytelling.
Oh, and I mean, that final, soliloquy of the solution at the end, it's over 20 minutes long.
It is.
I mean, and it's so much dialogue to be hammered out, and it's just amazing to behold when you watch it, and it's even more amazing to think that they have how many times they probably had to shoot the damn thing.
Exactly, yeah, with angles and different shots and so on.
Yeah.
There is one thing that I do need to mention about the original that made me crazy all the way through the movie, is how pale the godmother was. She looked like she was already dead. It looks like pantomime. It's I don't know if this was sort of some sort of homage to theater.
Are we talking the princess, or was this the
princess? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, actually, a couple of women were older than
him. She looked really old. Yeah.
She did look really old, and the dark makeup around her eyes, like she just felt like she brought her own makeup artist who was used to doing theater, where they overdo the makeup so it looks better when you're sitting far back, right? And it was one of the few things that really bugged me about the movie was how overdone she seemed, right? And possibly it was a throwback to the fact that she is an elderly lady, and maybe and I know that like sort of that overdone makeup was a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Somebody re-edit some of this footage, and especially her shots, into a horror movie theme.
Yeah,
because you could easily do that with those shots, because she looks so death warmed over most of the time, and so angry when she speaks.
Yes,
no patience for anybody.
Yeah, and I liked that aspect, but you combine that with the makeup, and it did. It felt like something from a different movie.
Yeah, I can see where you might have got that. I didn't feel as strongly about it, but given some of the lighter nature of the film, at least the Lumet film, she does feel oddly out of place at times.
Exactly, and it didn't pull me out of the movie, but it was one of those sort of things that kind of glared out at me as like, that just doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah,
right. And maybe in 1974 it would have felt more natural being closer to the time. Yeah. But it just, again, I'm a modern movie watcher. I
think Dench was definitely better in the part.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say better, but certainly looked more natural in the part.
Yeah.
And that's
two different movies.
Yeah. But yeah, it just felt a little unnatural to me.
Yeah. All right. Well, this was a wonderful dive into the world of Agatha Christie. I, for one, am very much looking forward to the next Branagh movie, Death in the Nile.
As am I. I said I was not sure, feeling the weird way I do about Branagh, but I thoroughly enjoyed him in this movie, and I am looking forward to the...
Yeah, when he gets his mindset on something, he'll do it to death, because man, with him and his Shakespeare stuff, he sure did a lot of it. And continues to do so. But yeah, I'm glad to see this property in good hands with Kenneth Branagh. And, there's all this other Poirot stuff that I haven't even been exposed to yet. So I might try to backtrack some of that ITV stuff, because I hear that's pretty good too.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that Branagh's doing, is he's bringing a character that's primarily known to...
It's more
Anglophiles and English audiences, and bring it to...
It's actually very big in Japan as well.
I can imagine that it would be.
Poirot and Miss Marple.
Yeah. I can totally see that, actually.
They have animes.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. I didn't know this stuff existed. And they got animes and movies and things. I'm like, live action and cartoon. I'm like, wow.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool.
But yeah, he's sort of exposing it to more of an international audience, and I think that's pretty wonderful too.
Yeah, I don't think Poirot has ever been like up there with Sherlock Holmes and with North American audience well, hopefully these movies will do that for him. I'm hoping Death in the Nile is also successful, so we can continue getting more Agatha Christie novels adapted to the big screen for modern audiences. But who knows? Time will tell all. And if they do that, we'll cover it again down the road, I'm sure.
At some point, yes, because Death in the Nile has also been made into film.
That's right. Right.
So that we'll definitely be talking that once they're both out there for us to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, you can get on board the train with the rest of your fellow invaders by helping them find the show and leaving comments and questions and whatever else. We're always looking for the next suggestion for our fan challenges as well. You can communicate with us in all sorts of places at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com if you want to email us. And of course, you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, and Radio Public, and even frickin' YouTube. So make sure you spread the word and tell people where to find us. And don't forget to leave a quick rating and short review to help other people get their earballs on the show.
Yay, earballs.
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 We're pulling into the station with this one. That's it for Murder on the Orient Express. And we'll be back next week where we'll have another remake episodes. I don't know what we'll come up with next, so we'll get to do some more recasting. Until then, I've been Jason.
And I am always Sam.
And we are out of here.
With me is that I never believe I can do anything. I have to have enormous amounts of reassurance. Or I think really that 75 is old enough to retain as an age. I don't say I don't want to live longer, but one's thankfulness for the gift of life is, I think, stronger and more vital during those last 25 years than it ever has been before. It has some of the reality and intensity of dreams. I still enjoy dreaming enormously.